Welcome to the Brown Bagger Program, originating from CFRO 102.7 FM, True Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. As the city builds up, like cities all over the world, what is in Vancouver's transportation future? The city has so far avoided the clutter of freeways that curse places like Los Angeles and even Seattle, but now gas prices are going sky high and the public transit system still seems inadequate. Today we will hear from three experts recorded at a forum called Our Transportation Future. It was May 22, 2008, at the downtown campus of Simon Fraser University. We will hear from SFU Professor Anthony Pearl. Here we go.
Our second speaker will be Anthony Pearl. Anthony is Professor of Urban Studies and Director of the Urban Studies Program at SFU here. Before SFU, he was at the City University of New York, University of Calgary, and the Université Lumière in Lyon, France. His research crosses many disciplines and national boundaries. He's published many scholarly articles, books, done a lot of work for World Conference on Transportation Research, Canadian Transportation Research Forum. I first came across him in the Canadian Centre for Sustainable Transportation, which is now living at the University of Winnipeg. Anthony is on the board of Via Rail. He chairs a committee on intercity rail passenger citizen systems for the U.S. United States Transportation Research Board. He helped select a number of initiatives for Transport Canada's Urban Transportation Showcase program, which is a program geared towards testing things that can reduce climate change. He's also produced four books, and his latest he co-authored. It's called Transportation Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil, and it's published by EarthScan. I'm sure there's some available. I guess it could be subtitled, as Colin Campbell from ASPO would say, if you don't deal with reality, reality will deal with you.
Well, it's going to change from the past transportation planning paradigm, which I've put up before you. I think this is the universal principle that transportation alternatives have been conceived of for the past generation, for the most part. As Larry said, you know, even while studies show all the costs and all the problems and all the issues and the projections are going in exactly the wrong way, that's what's driving it. The idea that any change for the better, in quotes, has to be someone else doing it. That was the working hypothesis for most, not all, I'm overgeneralizing, but for the vast majority of transportation planning and development, and the results were largely unsuccessful for obvious reasons. That's going to be changing. And the premise in the book that I want to share with you and explore a little bit is that the next 10 years are going to see more change in transportation arrangements and practices and use of technology than the last 30 years did. So for those who are ready for some change, that'll be great news. For those who aren't ready, it's going to happen anyway. And it's going to happen because energy costs are going to drive change. I did talk about peak oil this morning, and I don't want to go into it. Perhaps we can in discussion. If there's definitional, conceptual, ideological issues, there's all sorts of things to talk about there. But I, not being an economist, I feel a little awkward saying, you know, let's just take some market evidence here. But that's what I will shorten it to and say, you know, in the last year, the price of oil has doubled and the price increases seem to be accelerating. They're not going to, it's not a straight line. You see, there's jagged ups and downs. But over the last 5 years, the trend has been up. There's been a rough quadrupling of oil prices. This starts to affect people already and will be the driver, in my view, of significant change. And transportation isn't the only thing that's affected by oil prices, but it's going to be the most affected because for a couple of reasons that I want to share with you. This sort of Pac-Man-like diagram shows just how successful the oil industry has been in making sure that transportation is utterly and totally dependent on oil. 95% of the world's mobility now is powered by oil, and we're very lucky here that we have even a small fraction of alternatives that are powered powered by other energy sources in much of the world, and in some of the most mobile, high mobility parts of the world. It's a very small fraction, less than 5%, that's powered by anything other than oil. So oil price increases mean transportation price increases in much of the world. Another way of looking at it is how much of the world's finite and scarce, increasingly expensive oil resource are we shoveling or pumping into our tanks for mobility. And it's more than half. Globally, it's 56% of the world's oil consumption is used for transportation. And in Canada, it's even more. It's closer to 60%. In the U.S., it's even more than that because we're less efficient than average than the global average in our energy use for transportation, which is mostly oil. There's a lot of other uses for transportation. And I did a talk last week for the Rotary Foundation had a Zenith conference for young leaders of tomorrow. And I said to them, you know, if you just were given an efficiency exercise, and this didn't say anything about what the categories were or what the issue was, if you were just given that, said these are pieces of a consumption of something, and we need to improve efficiency. Where do we need to work to do that? And everyone under 25 said, you know, you got to take that red piece and work on it because that's where the potential for efficiency is logically going to be the greatest. It's where there's the most consumption going on, not in the least one. That 9%, the little green triangle there, the feedstocks. If anyone here takes medicine on a regular basis, or maybe an antihistamine, or maybe they took an aspirin in preparation for tonight's discussions here, those are all produced with oil in them. And I would say that many of those uses of oil are quite essential. There's not going to be as much room to squeeze those, or there shouldn't be on ethical and other reasons as well. And as I've suggested, transportation has been growing less efficient in its use of energy, particularly oil, since 1990. Some people would connect this to globalization. Others would connect it to, you know, sort of auto and aviation industry strategies to just maximize their short-term activity and size of vehicles and intensity of travel. But the bottom line is that, you know, most other sectors, those other pieces of the pie that I mentioned, have already at least started to figure out ways to get a little more efficient in their use of energy, certainly more than transportation. The projections from the International Energy Agency, although these are sort of pre-oil spike, pre-$100 a barrel oil, suggest that the increase in transportation will actually not abate and accelerate. So that's a sort of a business as usual that cannot continue with ever increasing oil prices. And as a result, and this isn't meant to take away from anything that Larry was saying, because I agree with all of it, and I try and I've worked in environmental impact assessment of some transportation issues as well. It's just that in the next 10 years, in this period of transport revolution, I think that those problems and issues are going to be crowded in a good way by even more pressing needs, that is to say, getting the energy to keep our societies, people and freight moving when and where, or at least some of when and where they want to go. So some of the things that we've been sort of worried about justifiably, but to little effect because the system hasn't really taken those concerns into account, will be sort of second-tier issues. And the first-tier issues will be just how to keep things moving. And that's where transport revolutions come in. For those of you who were patient this morning, I said I would show you a solar-powered airplane tonight, and I will now suggest that this is not going to get us to a soft landing of energy transition. It's an example of the kind of techno-fix that is not yet ready for prime time. This is the world's first solar-powered aircraft. The good news is that it uses no oil and produces no emissions. The bad news is that it carries no people or cargo, and that it crashed on its third test flight. Now, this isn't to be a Luddite. It's to say that, you know, we're going to have, in that 10 years going forward, we're going to have to choose between transport solutions that are ready for immediate use, for prime time deployment, and those that are further down the road. I hope, although I'm not confident, I hope in my lifetime there will be solar-powered aviation options, but it's certainly not going to be something I would bet my life and climb on in the next 10 years, and I don't think it's going to even be available during that period. So that's not a transport revolution. The definition we came up with for our book is something that has a significant impact, and by significant we mean it has to occur in a relatively short time period, 25 years or less, and it has to affect more than by more than 50%, either increasing or decreasing the transport activity, the amount of kilometers, vehicle kilometers or ton kilometers, and affecting more than 10% of the society's population. So that specialized, you know, Segways and pogo sticks are innovative in their own way, but they're not going to generate transport revolutions, nor will solar-powered aircraft within the time period that we need them. So what will happen? Well, the book goes through and goes into much more detail than I will here, and says that there's three basic trajectories that are going to be part of these transport revolutions. Remember, these are sudden changes in 25 years or less. Electricity, which we have someone who's able to connect transport and electricity following me. I'll set the stage for her because she's got both ends of it in her portfolio. Electric motors are incredibly efficient, and electric energy is not an energy source, it's a carrier. So you can blend more sustainable energy sources incrementally over time as we figure them out, and we don't have to have the big bang solution of a solar-powered aircraft or equivalent hydrogen fuel cell or something like that. Electric motors have been around almost as long as the internal combustion engine, and they have a lot to recommend them. Rail and water are more energy efficient to begin with, and they can use renewable energy either through electricity or wind directly for marine transportation, which is coming back, and I can talk about that later. So those are going to be growth modes, and air and road transportation by motor vehicles powered by internal combustion engines will be declining. We're also going to see, and this isn't meant as some sort of grand plan for nationalizing or socializing all the transportation, but we're going to see sharing of vehicles, whether it's public buses, whether it's trains, whether it's car sharing, or cooperative types of arrangements. There's just more efficiency in not having single occupant vehicles, and that's going to be a feature of many of these transport revolutions. And these revolutions are going to happen, again, not just because some of us, probably most of us in this room, would think they're a good idea, but because we have to. If we're going to have an economy that can grow sustainably in the future, it's going to have to be, the transport sector is going to have to stop using so much oil and wasting so much of it. This is from a trucking protest in the U.S. Last week. The trucking industry in the U.S., especially the independent operators, are really going to the wall. They're like the canaries in the cage. Their fuel prices go up. The freight rates don't go up fast enough. You can't have an economy based on trucking the way it's currently organized, and they're feeling the effects of that. And then it will also help the environment. I lived for 12 years in Calgary, which was a place that figured out early on how to build wind turbines in the Crow's Nest Pass area, put the electricity into an open grid, and send it out the other end to run their light rail system. And 100% of the energy that's used by the C-Train system there is renewable, zero-emission sources. So these kinds of changes will be good for the environment and the economy, but again, my point is that they're going to come not because we want them to and we know that that's what we should do. It'll come because we have to make those changes. And what would and some of those changes will have to happen in innovative ways, again, combining pieces that we already have, like electric transportation with rubber tires that can use streets, but also have a little slot down the middle of the road, which can be shared with other vehicles as well. But here you get, you know, sort of a combination, this is in Padua, Italy, of all the best features of rail transportation at a cost that's a lot closer to bus transportation. We're going to need those kinds of innovative combinations of things that already work to do even better. And in large parts of the lower mainland here, we're not going to have the time or the money to build SkyTrain or heavy rail technology in the 10 years or so we have to deal with this current and growing energy challenge. So we're going to need other types of innovations, and they are out there. We have to be able to choose intelligently between the ones that can actually deliver, like something like this guided bus transit system, and the solar-powered aircraft. We have to have people making decisions who can tell the difference between the bets that will work and the ones that aren't going to. And there's a lot of synergy within, once you have an electric transportation system. The slides on your left are from Dresden in Germany. They have a tram, a rail system, light rail system for the city, which also is now used to move freight around. Cargo tram, it's called. On the bottom right, you have Governor Schwarzenegger taking a ride in an electric sports car, the Tesla. And above, we have our good new trolley buses on Robson Street here. So there's an infrastructure synergy that can happen when you start moving to electric transportation. We call them traction corridors. It's a common electric distribution system that can run, that could run trams, buses, cars, and trucks. There's technology to connect in. There's no reason why trucks today couldn't be using the existing wires that are out there for the buses with meters and pay-as-they-go type technology. And that could help pay, I think, for some of the expansion that's going to be necessary anyway. So getting to that critical mass requires leadership. And we tend to assume that leadership is something that's very rare in transportation. In the book, I wrote the section on historical examples of transport revolutions. These have happened before. The one that I'll focus on tonight is deals with the U.S. Getting very serious in a very short period of time about pressing the pause button on mass motorization. That happened during World War II when these posters were created and sent out to people. These things may seem very bizarre or odd, but they weren't. But they were leaders behind them. Here's a man you've probably never heard of. And Donald Nelson, who was the chairman of the War Production Board. The U.S. entered World War II late compared to Canada and many other countries. Remember, December 7th was the key day for them in 1941. January 16th, 1942, this War Production Board is created to basically manage an economic transition in a very concentrated, compressed time period. The first thing they decided to do was to cancel civilian car production. Notice the timeline. January 16th, they're created. February 10th, they issue the first order. It's convenient statistically that the war began at basically after a full production year was done in 1941. The U.S. produced 3.8 million cars in 1941. By 1943, there were 143 civilian cars produced in the United States. And at least until some of the latest SUVs that Ford has put out, those were the biggest, heaviest vehicles they ever made during that period, and the toughest ones, I'm sure, still along the way. The point is that they were able to make that transition, and it took, but they didn't initiate it. That's the key to remember, that when pointed in the right direction and given a nice push from government, industry rose to the challenge in transportation. And maybe this time, instead of tanks, it could be electric trains and buses that Ford, which is, I just read today, cutting back by double-digit percentages its manufacturing capacity because of rising energy prices and reduced demand. So there's a need for leadership. These things sometimes get to a point where crises push people forward. Why did Donald Nelson make this decision? Is it because he hated cars? I doubt it. Is it because he was some sort of rabid radical? I also doubt it. It was because of necessity. It was because he had the rational ability to look at the American industrial and military and strategic and energy situations, all of which were connected then as they are now and say, we've got to do something fast. Cars are the single largest, at that time, source of consumption of steel, of glass, of rubber, all of which were needed for military use at the time, the single largest consumption of gasoline as well. Gas and tire rationing came in. There was a 40% drop in vehicle kilometers in just 2 years, not 25, but 2 years. And a public transportation and rail transportation use doubled, more than doubled during that time. So where does that leave us? And I'll close on this slide. I think in the book we offer a key principle, which is that we know for both the health of the planet, health of our living spaces, and health of our own physical bodies, we have problems with our transportation system. We know now, I think it's more apparent literally by the day, that the energy we need to keep things moving is not going to be available at an affordable price that can keep our economy working. We know that we're in a hole, in other words, when it comes to transportation needs. And I think that the first principle of getting out of that hole has to be, once you recognize the situation, you've got to stop digging, by which I mean stop doing things, stop investing resources and committing to plans that were designed on different assumptions that didn't take climate change clearly into account, that didn't take energy scarcities, especially oil depletion, into account. We're going to need those resources to do things differently. And this isn't about sort of going back to the dark ages and ending transportation development. It's about redesigning future transportation systems to take account of future needs and future realities. And that's where that leadership piece, I think, can happen. It has happened in the past, and it will happen. I just hope that it happens sooner rather than later. Thank you.
Anyways, my question is directed at Dr. Pearl. It's about the situation that's happening right now in Israel with Israel and Nissan. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all. Nissan
Project
and
Better Place.
The other third party.
Renault.
Right. Do you see that as a transportation revolution, or is it just sort of another stopgap thing like hydrogen-powered cars?
Well, just to fill in the gaps, there is a Silicon Valley billionaire who convinced the Israeli government that they should their next Google equivalent would be to lead the world in electric car uptake and applications. And the organization model of this would be that people wouldn't own the cars. They would just sign contracts and pay by the kilometer and the hour for using them. But you'd have your own car. It's just sort of like a lease arrangement. And the Israeli government's put tax breaks and other sort of regulatory incentives in place for this. And the claim is that Renault and Nissan are going to roll out their electric vehicles there within the next 2 to 5 years, because there's a guaranteed market for it, and Israel will do its best, since it doesn't have a lot of oil of its own, to make sure that it's renewable generation of electricity, or maybe nuclear, given their proclivities, that might be part of it as well. What will it mean in the long run? It will probably accelerate the deployment of electric cars, and it may test the model for sort of replacing the old gas guzzlers that, that people will feel less risk in buying a $30,000, $40,000 equivalent vehicle if they can, sort of pay, $200 a month or whatever it is, plus a kilometer charge for this. And if it breaks, they can give it back. Or if it becomes obsolete, it's not a sunk cost in the way that, another type of experimental vehicle might be. So they're trying to be a catalyst. The people involved are applying sort of new thinking from the information age to the transportation issues, which again breaks from the idea that in the past, if this would have been done under the old model, the one of the last 30 years, it would be, let's find some, sort of guinea pig population, someone else who either has never had cars before or is too poor to have cars, and give them this, sort of experiment and see if they survive. And the difference in Israel is they're trying to make this a mainstream approach that that people would use as a first choice. So it does have some promise. What the outcome, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. I mean, transport revolutions have lots of uncertainty in them. And if anyone tells you they know exactly, how many bikes or cars or electric buses are going to be there in 2030 or 2025, it's unrealistic, I think.
You are tuned to speeches from the forum Our Transportation Future, May 22, 2008. It was part of the Shifting Gears series of public discussions on Greater Vancouver's transportation options. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, your listener-supported radio station.